What's up, everyone? Welcome to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Aubrey, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts Cleo and Daniela for a fact-filled episode that's way overdue in terms of topic.
Hey, y'all, it's Cleo here. And before we get to talking about that topic, which we'll reveal to you in just another moment, don't forget to head on over to your favorite form of social media and tweet, post, or blog your questions, comments, and other thoughts regarding today's episode.
Hey there, I'm Daniela, of course, you know, last but not least. Yeah, you'll find our show on Twitter at the handle at ISGP Forum and on Facebook if you go to facebook.com/ISGP Forum. So what's this overdue topic we've got going on today, Aubrey?
Well, I say that it's overdue because it's a very timely topic that you hear on the daily, especially if you frequent online media or, you know, read magazines or newspapers or watch the news. Plus, it's a broad enough umbrella that it impacts almost every other topic we've ever discussed here on the forum, including food and water security, infectious disease spread, sea level rise, and, you know, everything else. Because of this, we've kind of tended to assume that our listeners have a basic understanding of the topic. And even if they don't, we often take for granted that they believe the topic is a reality, it's happening, and it's a serious detriment.
If you say topic one more time without actually telling us what the topic is.
Right. Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah. So the topic, if you hadn't guessed already, is actually climate change.
I get what you're saying, Aubrey. We've talked about climate change a lot in past episodes, especially as an influencer of other issues, but we actually haven't gone into tons of detail about climate change itself, and there's a lot of detail out there.
Which is why this episode is going to be jam-packed with information that will hopefully serve as a summary of the climate science data that we have on hand.
And, spoiler alert, in the end, those data are going to tell us that climate change is, in fact, happening, and that it would be in our best interest to take action before climate-related threats become too severe. Of course, we'll also let our presenter and debaters offer up some suggestions about who can and should be taking what actions.
But, before we get ahead of ourselves, let's say who our presenter was and at what conference our debaters met.
That seems reasonable, so someone go for it.
Okay, so today's episode is based on the policy position paper written by Professor Ines Fung for the 2016 ISGP conference called Climate Impact on National Security, which is held at the United States Army War College in Pennsylvania.
Professor Fung was the lead writer from the U.S. on a publication called Climate Change, Evidence and Causes, which was released jointly in 2014 by the National Academy of Sciences and the Royal Society. In her other life, Professor Fung is a professor of atmospheric science at Berkeley.
In her policy position paper, Professor Fung argues that evidence abounds in support of the fact that the Earth's climate is changing. She also explains how and why we see seasonal and regional variations in climate systems, and why, importantly, this does not, I repeat, does not, mean that climate changes we're witnessing are just another ebb and flow of a natural cycle. More on this later, though.
So let's start the factoids from the top, shall we? We'll kick it off with a statistic that, as an electrochemist working on repurposing CO2, I've probably included in every PowerPoint I've created since the fall of 2015 when I started grad school. The fact is that atmospheric CO2 levels reached a concentration of 400 ppm in 2015, and that number continues to increase. PPM, by the way, is just a unit of measure often used for concentrations of chemicals or contaminants, and it stands for parts per million. 1 ppm can be kind of hard to visualize, so there are a few analogies out there that might help you out a bit. 1 ppm is like saying 1 inch in 16 miles, or 1 minute in 2 years. CO2 concentrations are at 400 ppm, so in analogy form, that's 400 inches in 16 miles, aka 0.006 miles, or 33 feet.
But that level of technicality isn't even necessary to grasp the significance of the 400 ppm value. All you have to do is check out some comparisons. Namely, 400 ppm as a value is 85 ppm higher than atmospheric CO2 levels back in 1957. And it's a 43% increase since the start of the Industrial Revolution.
And quick history lesson in our otherwise science-driven show, if it's been a while since you've taken a social studies class, The Industrial Revolution lasted from about 1760 until sometime in the 1820 to 1840 range, and featured a transition to new machine manufacturing and factory processes. So when it comes to old-timey industrialization, the world witnessed quite the emission spike.
Professor Fung explains that this CO2 spike is, in fact, attributed mostly to the burning of fossil fuels, which temporarily accords not only with the increased use of fossil fuels in history, but also with the simultaneous recorded decrease in atmospheric oxygen.
Which, of course, is occurring because burning things actually requires oxygen. It's really just a throwback to your high school chemistry class when you learned about combustion reactions. Substance plus oxygen react to form CO2 and water.
Nerd alert.
Shut it.
Okay, guys. So, why is this important? To keep with Aubrey's reference on high school classes, you might remember that plants chew up CO2 during photosynthesis. It's kind of their thing. So, why is it bad to have a drastic increase in atmospheric CO2? Well, you might also remember a term called the greenhouse effect.
To understand the greenhouse effect, it's actually pretty instructive to first understand how an actual greenhouse works. The concept is pretty simple, actually. The sun's rays of visible light travel through the glass walls of a greenhouse where they are, in part, absorbed by plants and other surfaces and converted to heat, aka infrared radiation. The infrared radiation gets trapped within the greenhouse because it has a different wavelength than the original visible light that passed straight through.
The longer wavelength of infrared radiation can't pass through the glass quite so easily.
Right, so yeah, the heat is trapped inside. Now, greenhouses are used strategically, so they're a good thing, for plants and such.
But when you apply the same greenhouse effect to the Earth, well, that's not such a good thing. At least not at the scale we're witnessing. Greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, including molecules like water vapor, methane, and you guessed it, CO2, act like that glass roof. The sun's visible light reaches the Earth's surface, a bunch of it is turned into infrared radiation or heat, and when it bounces back towards, well, space, it gets trapped by those greenhouse gases.
And Professor Fung explains that evidence of this theoretical effect has been recorded in reality. Namely, two Department of Energy radiation monitoring sites, one in the Great Plains and the other in Alaska, found that the 22 ppm increase in atmospheric CO2 levels occurring between years 2000 and 2010 contributed to a measurable increase in atmospheric energy, aka an increase in energy trapped near the Earth's surface. If you've ever heard the term radiative forcing, that's the fancy name for this. If you haven't, well, forget I ever mentioned it.
People who don't necessarily believe in climate change often claim that this temperature and energy increase near the Earth's surface is attributed to fluctuations in the sun's output. But this is so not true. The sun's output fluctuations are real, but they occur on an 11-year cycle, so they can't be correlated with the steady temperature increases observed over the past decades.
Decades? Don't you mean since, oh, I don't know, the late 1800s at the very least?
Yeah, like tens of decades.
Well, in any case, we can put some numbers behind this temperature increase.
This is one of those episodes, isn't it? One of those with a lot of numbers.
Yeah, I hate to break it to you, but yes, it is. When it comes to air temperatures at the Earth's surface, where we live and all, the rate of temperature increase has itself been increasing over the years. The result? Well, I'm sure y'all have seen infographics online about how recent months just keep breaking temperature records.
I've absolutely seen those, and I don't even social media that much.
But those infographics don't represent anomalies. Here's the thing. Since 1998, less than 20 years ago, we've witnessed the 10 warmest years that have occurred here on Earth in the past 200 years. So next time you and some 2,000 other people band together to break the Guinness World Record for juggling bean bags while eating a slice of pizza and standing on one foot, or something like that, just realize that you've kind of already been a part of history.
As much as I love a good pizza eating, beanbag juggling YouTube video, we have more important things to think about here. You two were just talking about air temperatures, right? Well, I'm sure you know that air temperatures aren't the only ones affected. Oceans absorb around 90% of the heat added to our environment. And while I know the three of us would do just about anything for that kind of extra heat in most ISGP conference rooms, the ocean isn't quite so desperate.
Whether ocean or air-related, when it comes to temperature increases, many people have accurately pointed out that the magnitude of temperature increase is not the same from year to year, nor is it necessarily always a bigger increase this year than the last.
And the debaters noted that there's a perfectly logical explanation for that, having to do with natural fluctuations in climate, which have always existed. Heck, it's also why the magnitude of temperature increase is different from one region to another.
Let's tease this out a bit so everyone clearly understands what we mean here.
Of course. I think this point is probably best made using some examples. So, during La Niña periods, the eastern equatorial Pacific is cooler than normal, so naturally the increase in air temperature slows down some. On the other hand, when El Niño rolls around, which is kind of the opposite of La Niña for our simplistic purposes today, well, air temperature increases are exacerbated. This was observed most recently in 2015, leading to way above average mean temperatures in every contiguous US state.
The debaters noted that these natural climatic fluctuations have increased in both duration and intensity. When we combine these fluctuations with the general trend of increasing temperatures, we see that the fluctuations just modulate the amount of increase we observe annually. It's really like a layering effect. The big picture here, though, and I cannot stress this enough, is that even though La Niña and El Niño change the magnitude of temperature increase, there is still a temperature increase when you average across all the days in a calendar year.
So, with all this talk of heat, it's pretty hard not to think about other pretty definitive indicators of our changing climate, such as melting ice sheets and glaciers, not to mention the plethora of other outcomes this brings. So, when it comes to Arctic sea ice, well, let's just say our polar bear friends have been in trouble since at least 1979. Since this time, sea ice has been steadily declining at a rate of around -7% per decade. On top of that, ice has been slow to grow back in the winter months, resulting in a major net loss of ice. For example, the Greenland ice sheet experienced mass loss at a rate of around -230 gigatons per year from 2003 to 2011.
Haven't I heard somewhere, though, that the Western Antarctic ice sheet is melting, but the eastern half is growing? How can some of the ice be growing, considering what we've been discussing?
That's really, truly a great question. And it's one that a lot of people have because you're right, it does not sound intuitive. But here's the deal. According to the debaters, warmer ocean water, which we've already mentioned today, allows for more water vapor to exist in the atmosphere. This means that heavier rain and snowfalls will occur in certain regions, like eastern Antarctica.
So, more accumulation and compacting of snow results in a buildup of ice where this enhanced precipitation occurs.
But it turns out that ice accumulation in the Antarctic cannot compete with ice loss in the Arctic. So there's no need to confuse yourself anyway. We're still at a net decrease in ice content overall.
And if you've listened to our show in the past, chances are you're pretty familiar with one of the most real-world consequences of ice melt, sea level rise. That's not to say that sea level rise isn't also impacted by the oceans expanding due to warming, but whatever. You get my point. And plus, it made for a seamless transition.
Not now that you mentioned it out loud.
Whatever. It just needed to be mentioned anyway. I don't think we need to go into the specifics of sea level rise today, since we've discussed it so much in the past.
Fair enough. Another thing we've talked about a bunch in the past is how extreme weather events, which were once considered rare, like droughts, floods, and heat waves, are occurring now with greater frequency. Professor Fung also mentions this in her paper.
So, the main new takeaway there is that just because we experience what seem to be random hot or even cold weather extremes, that doesn't mean that climate change isn't happening. As we alluded to earlier, climate change plus natural climatic fluctuations can together be influencers of extreme weather events, both regionally and seasonally. Examples, anyone?
Okay. So how about the winter of 2014 to 2015? While I was busy tanning on the Florida beaches in between classes senior year, record warm temperatures were recorded in the western US, while record cold temperatures were noted in 24 other states.
Keeping with that winter, Oklahoma and Texas received almost 2 times more rainfall than normal, while California continued to experience severe drought. For our Canadian listeners, the eastern half of your country experienced record snowfall, while the western half dealt with 4 times more wildfires than average, etc., etc.
And to think we haven't even discussed climate change impacts on ecosystems yet, including terrestrial, freshwater, and marine variants. These impacts are pretty intense.
They can certainly affect the survival of certain plant and animal species, but even if protecting furry things isn't your number one priority, there are other reasons for you to be concerned about ecosystems for, say, economic or other social reasons. I'm feeling like this might be another spot where examples would be informative.
I couldn't agree more. Okay, so for example, lots of weeds, fungi, and pests thrive in warmer conditions that are wetter and also have higher than usual amounts of CO2. So down the line, detriments related to that could threaten food and water security and even public health.
Well, speaking of food security, Professor Fung mentioned that heightened nighttime temperatures have been shown to lower corn yields in the United States. And when it comes to water security, California's drought has only not cost a decrease in agricultural production because of the state's major reliance on a finite supply of groundwater.
Plus, ocean acidification and algal blooms have already begun impacting the shellfish industry. That's right, we see you, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. Or the debaters see you, I guess.
Touche.
And to make matters worse, Professor Fung explains that even if we straight up stopped greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we would not revert back to the climate state we were in 200 years ago.
Not that we'd be able to stop overnight anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, even if we could, it wouldn't do what we would need it to do because it would take literally thousands of years for atmospheric CO2 to dissolve in the ocean, reach the ocean's depths, and finally be buried in ocean sediment.
So what on earth can we do? It's pretty clear that there's no getting used to one or another of these problems because they're just going to keep changing as the climate keeps changing. Well, for this reason, Professor Fung says that we need to commit to maintaining weather satellites that exist for making observations of atmospheric chemistry, photosynthesis, sea levels, glacial masses, and the like. Sensors could then be tied to real-time observations and warning systems.
Plus, the debaters thought that expanded use of satellites would help scientists refine climate modeling and projections, which would certainly help when trying to influence policy decisions.
Seems pretty logical, no?
Maybe, but Professor Fung also noted that this commitment isn't necessarily in place.
Okay, well then.
It kind of gets worse, though. According to our presenter, we have an incomplete understanding of climate system dynamics, which doesn't bode well for our ability to offer warnings about severe weather or other climate-related risks to society.
Not to mention the fact that climate mitigation and adaptation measures implemented primarily at the local or regional level really do occur in isolation. Yet, understanding impacts on national security, food and water security, human health, and greater society would require a coordinated look at the national scale by multiple federal agencies. Again, not really happening presently, according to Professor Fung.
And while reducing emissions is an admirable and needed goal, we already mentioned that this won't stop the climate impacts already coming our way. That's why prepping for and adapting to climate change is urgently required. As such, Professor Fung outlines her suggested policy options by creating 4 general categories of action. 1, government policies. 2, food and water security. 3, modernizing infrastructure. And 4, preparedness. Let's summarize each in turn. Cleo, you go first.
Okay, 1, government policies. In an overarching sense here, Professor Fung says it's necessary to implement a national program that can identify which assets and sectors are threatened by climate change. Makes sense.
Sure, but there has got to be more that we can task our government with here.
For sure. It was stated that both vehicle and appliance energy efficiency standards, such as corporate average fuel economy, need to be increased. Plus, local and state programs need to work toward increasing the amount of alternative energy incorporated into the greater energy supply. That's part 1, government policies.
Part two, then, is food and water security, which you can totally learn more about by checking out a bunch of our past episodes. In the context of this debate, though, Professor Fung wrote that programs to manage freshwater resources and programs to develop crops that use water more efficiently just need to be established. She also wanted to see the water pricing structure change to discourage wasting water, and so that people will, stop brushing their teeth with the faucet running for once.
It's worth mentioning that the debaters were a little critical when it came to water management planning. While the majority of water programs have focused on conserving water or reducing water pollution, they wondered if we should be paying more attention to exploiting new sources of water, much like we've been doing with energy.
Good point.
I'll jump in here with a third policy component then, modernizing infrastructure. Minimizing damage in coastal areas, plus limiting development in vulnerable areas after a disaster has already occurred, is critical. This will involve revising building codes and land development regulations.
Ah, the age-old question of rebuild or relocate. I see.
Yep. And then there's resilience planning. Sea level rise and other climate impacts need to be proactively incorporated into plans for new airport runways, highways, and coastal structures, whatever their purpose. Urban areas need to become more resilient with flood zone risk maps and the like.
Finally, there's Professor Fung's fourth component, preparedness. These suggestions seem a bit intuitive, but are certainly worth mentioning. We're talking about the need for things like backup systems for water and electricity, emergency plans for storm surges, and protocols for people and machinery experiencing increased heat exposure.
And preparedness is so broad that it really includes everyone, ranging from the highest-ranking government officials to community members. If we can't convince this full range of people that climate change is happening with major detrimental consequences, we're going to be seriously in trouble. That's why, according to the debaters, it's super important to tailor appropriate climate messages to appropriate audiences using appropriate messengers.
And by appropriate climate messages, the debaters meant community-specific information that would help a community not only survive, but also prosper in the face of climate impacts.
And that is how the debaters hope we'd be able to accomplish a massive cultural paradigm shift.
A big picture ending to a big picture topic. I like it.
All right, so to recap today's conversation, there's a plethora of evidence suggesting that climate change is a real problem and that it's tied to the burning of fossil fuels. This evidence includes, but is not limited to, air and ocean temperature increases and, of course, ice melting. But it's not worth humanity getting all defensive. We caused a problem, it happened, let's move on by mitigating damages and adapting to what can't be prevented.
Mitigation and adaptation will necessarily involve policy action at the local, state, and national levels. And it'll probably require that we pay more attention to things like emergency planning, infrastructure, alternative energy, and both food and water security.
So, with that said, what's your take on climate change? Are you convinced that humans are causing the unprecedented trends we've discussed today? If not, what are your reservations? Should it even really matter, the cause? Should we start taking action?
Don't forget to send us your thoughts regarding climate change, sea level rise, ice melt, and polar bears on Twitter using our handle @ISGPForum or on Facebook by searching ISGP's The Forum.
This is a big topic, so we're looking for some equally big opinions.
We hope you learned something from today's fact-packed episode on climate change. That just about wraps things up for us. So, on behalf of everyone at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, thanks for socializing with science today, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.